verse 2 of the psalm. Unusual in a way, this part of the psalm, because the psalmist is actually praying that those who are unjustly treating him will be converted, will change, which is obviously a prayer, but you don't often get that prayer in the psalm. It's usually praying that they'll be punished. Here it's praying that they'll change, which is lovely, and I'm sure you've prayed that prayer whenever you've been out of sorts with someone. You're hoping that that person will see it differently, or, you know. So let's read it. How long, verse 2, you leaders, shall I be dishonored with shame, falsely accused, and often falsely accused, people presume it's right. So he's suffering shame. How long, you leaders, shall I be dishonored with shame? How long will you love falsehood and seek after lies? He's being unjustly accused. Know this, he says, know this. Yahweh has set apart the faithful one for himself. Yahweh hears me when I call to him. So know this. Be careful, because Yahweh is listening to me. Yahweh hears the cry of the poor. You know, Yahweh hears the cry of the afflicted. So if you continue this process of unjust accusation, you are actually opposing Yahweh, not just me. So know this, he says. The faithful one needs a little bit of explanation for you. It's not as easy to do here without all the graphics, but you'll please forgive me. I'll do it as best I can. The word faithful is chassid in Hebrew. And you've probably heard me use the word chesed, be with you. Chesed, in fact, is it in that text I just read you? Chesed is God's saving kindness, God's chesed. So the chassid, as a descriptive word of a certain, are those who welcome God's grace, God's loving kindness, steadfast love. It's translated quite a few ways, but I think the simplest way to call it is loving kindness. It's a very simple word, chesed. Chesed, and they're the ones who welcome it and respond to it. God's chesed means God's, sometimes it means God's covenanted love. Chesed is something that you experience in the family. It's a kind of family bond. And if it's not a family bond, then by an oath or a covenant or a contract, somebody not in the family kind of commits themselves in a way that's like a family bond, you know? And God commits himself. I will be your God, you will be my people. I will love you, keep my commandments. So there's a mutual contract or something, whatever the word is, covenant might be a better word. And God's chesed is God's faith, God's faithful love. The chassid are those who welcome it and respond appropriately. In other words, they're in communion with God and they're faithfully carrying out their part of the bargain of the covenant. So once again, verse 3, know this, Yahweh has set apart the faithful one for himself. There's a special relationship between Yahweh and the one who is chassid, who is welcoming the chesed of God. Yahweh hears me when I call to him. That reminded me, and I can remind you of another text, I'll give you the reference. It's a different word, but it picks it up beautifully. Malachi chapter 3, verse 17, the prophet Malachi. Do you need a biro? Do you want a biro? Oh, I beg your pardon. I didn't realize. Malachi chapter 3, verse 17, has this beautiful text. They shall be mine, says Yahweh of hosts, my special possession on the day when I act. They shall be mine. Here we are. Now that word special possession is very beautiful. In Hebrew it's segula. The segula is your special possession. And I'll just give you my little image for a segula, which is quite accurate, but my image, for what it's worth, is, you know how little, well, you do know better than I do, little children have a little kind of a scrawny doll that they've just about choked to death. It's a rag doll that they drag around with them everywhere they walk, and they take it to bed with them, and they take it everywhere. It's not there, they're crying, and it's got to come in the car with them, and if they haven't got it, they're all anxious, a little whatever. That's a segula. It's such a precious little thing, and you look at it, the poor little doll's just about eaten up, and the dog's mauled it, but there it is. It's really quite special. That text is Malachi 3, verse 17. The segula text. So that's the special possession. So God's kind of saying in that text, you're my special possession. Now in the psalm it doesn't use the word segula, but it's got a bit of that feeling in it. Then comes verse 4 to 5, a plea for the conversion of his enemies. Enemies meaning those who are treating him badly and falsely accusing him, and he wants justice. You've noticed the imperative there, know this, that was in verse 3. In verse 4 and 5 there are six more imperatives coming fast and furious, which actually means that there are seven imperatives. There's something in that too. It's a symbolic total seven, you know. So I'll read it for you. Tremble with fear, he tells his enemies, and stop sinning. Tremble with fear. Now, for those who weren't here last week, I'm sorry, but we did a lot of that last week. The fear of Yahweh we did, and we also did the anger of God, and looked at both those concepts, so you can catch up with that later. So, tremble with fear. In other words, realize that God is God. And be awe before God, and don't just go on your lying way and think you can get away with it. I mean, realize what you're doing and stop sinning. Ponder on your beds, you know, and be silent. They're accusing him. Be silent. Stop it. Then goes on, offer right sacrifices. Go to the cult. Go to the temple and offer what the law says you're supposed to offer if you're sorry for sin, and you know there were certain rituals that were meant to be carried out. Go ahead with that. And finally, put your trust in Yahweh. So this is what he's wanting his enemies to do. If they do all that, then they'll stop all this false accusing of him. Put your trust in Yahweh. The verse 4, tremble with fear. I say this because I'll need to do something in a moment that'll bear this out. The Greek Bible, that is the Septuagint version of that, actually doesn't say tremble with fear. It says be angry and stop sinning. I mentioned that because in the Latin it's also be angry, and in the English translations from the Latin, which is the Douay version, the kind of the traditional, often you'll find that text written, be angry. In fact, it's in Paul quotes that text in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 23, and he quotes it as, be angry and stop sinning. Because he's quoting, of course, he's writing in Greek, he's quoting from the Greek Bible, not the Hebrew Bible. There's a lot to tell you there, and it doesn't add up to a lot. But just to be honest with you, that's why you sometimes will see that translation. I'm not here to say which is right or wrong, because I don't know, because you have to keep remembering that the Hebrew text was only fixed in about the year 100 AD. Prior to that, there would have been flexibility in the scrolls, and there would have been variations, and it could even be that the 200 BC, that is, let's say 250 years before the fixing of the classical Hebrew Bible, 250 years earlier, the Greek may have been translating from a more authentic original text. It's not impossible, of course. So you can't always presume the Hebrew's right and the Greek made a mistake. So anyhow, whatever of that, I'm giving you the Hebrew here, which is what all the translations now use. Verse 6. Many people ask themselves, who is going to enjoy happiness if the light of your face does not shine upon us? It's quite beautiful. This is now encouraging other people to not lose hope. Other people who are falsely accused, us, anyone he's writing for, other people who are hemmed in and have got no space. He's saying, no, keep trusting Yahweh, even if life's really hard for you. Because many people are asking this question, how am I going to enjoy happiness, Yahweh, unless the light of your face shines upon me? Profound prayer. Commenting on that verse, I'm reading now for you from a text that you know well, but you mightn't know the reference. It's Numbers chapter 6, verses 25 to 26. And that is the blessing that you are sometimes offered at Mass, and it comes from that priestly blessing. May Yahweh bless you and keep you, protect you, guard you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you. An image, but a beautiful one. And be gracious to you. There it is again. Grace you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. That's Numbers chapter 6, verse 25 to 26. So the psalmist is offering his personal testimony of trust in God in that dreadful situation that he was in. But God somehow gave him space. That's how he sees it. And he's telling them to trust in God even in a dark place. And then the psalm concludes. Verse 7. You have put more gladness in my heart than they have from abundance of grain and new wine. So clearly something beautiful has happened to him and he's thanking God for it. The word heart needs a bit of care all through the Bible, including the New Testament, so because our idea of heart isn't quite the same. Heart in the word lev is the Hebrew word, that's okay, L-E-B, but it's a soft B, lev, means heart. When they talk about heart, the other word that often gets linked with it is technically the word kidneys. So, okay, heart and kidneys. The heart was, very often we need to translate it mind. Very often. A person with a hard heart can mean, in English, a person with dull wits. So my gesture even went straight to my head, didn't it? But theirs doesn't. The heart means your centre, but it's higher. It's the centre of thoughts. It's the centre of affections, not all of them. Affections that are reasonable. Affections that are, if you like, higher affections. It's the centre of intention. It's the centre of will. It's you kind of at your rational best with all that involves by way of feeling, emotion, thought, will, etc. You need to know that, or the word heart can be a bit inadequately understood. They also have this other word, which I'll now mention. It's kidneys. Now, they understood, we know they're wrong, but they understood the kidneys were actually the way we'd understand our genitals. They were kind of was something to do with sexual drive, etc. So kidneys tended to be a word for irrational feelings. It could be anger, it could be jealousy, it could be envy. You know, the feelings that burst up in you from down there, gut feelings that, well, later on you think, why did I say that? Or what's going on here? It's not the higher feelings, if I can use the word higher. So it's that whole area that we don't have a lot of control over. And we can actually live lives that soften it we can do a lot about it. But they're instantaneous gut things that occur to us. So here he's talking about, you've put gladness in my heart, would mean to a Hebrew, I'm thinking better now as well as I can see my way through, I'm feeling better about life, all of that stuff. All right. Than other people get from grain. Verse 8, I lie down in peace and sleep comes at once. There's our second image. Space was the first one, hemmed in, given space. Now he's quite able to lie down, and instead of being depressed and waking up exactly at 2 o'clock every blooming night, I mean whenever he goes to bed, he now actually finds he has a good night's sleep. Wow, isn't that wonderful? Wouldn't you love it? So sleep comes at once because he is trusting in God. Peace needs a bit of help for us. Peace is a very, in English, it's actually not a very rich word at all. It comes from pax in Latin, and we have the word pact. Peace in English technically means a temporary cessation of war. The pax romana, the gates open, and there's always war going on, and blow me down, we've got this little gap. Well, there's no war going on. We call that peace, which is pretty typical of the Roman military empire methods of thinking. Not in Hebrew. Shalom means wholeness. There's peace when the sheep are having lambs, when the grass is high, when the wheat is wonderful, when everything's nodding, when the weather's perfect, when everyone's at harmony, when the apple trees are producing beautiful apples and the figs have got fig trees and kids are running around and having a wonderful time and young people are getting married and they're loving each other and the old men are sitting out there chatting away, smoking in their thing, and the women are just, I don't know, what do you do when you're working? But enjoying it, Betty. So that's shalom. Shalom is, my best image for it, it might help you, is an orchestra. I think that picks up the image of shalom to me quite perfectly, where every instrument is different, let's say. Every instrument is playing to perfection, but every instrument is also listening to the next one. So the tuba isn't dominating, or the violins aren't too strident. Everything's ready and sensitive to everyone else, but they're all giving of all they're giving. You know what I mean? Everyone's alive, vital, and right on key, but very sensitive to all the differences. So a peaceful parish is not like a cemetery. A peaceful parish will be when everyone in it is offering their gift to the community with joy and everyone's being enriched by it. And he concludes the psalm, "For I live placing all my trust in." So St. Augustine, if you want to know the text, it's book 9, and it's chapter 4 of book 9 of Augustine's Confessions. And it's a page, but I think you'll enjoy me reading it. And as I read it, you look at your psalm 4 and notice the little phrases. I hope you can pick them, even though they're slightly different. This is Augustine's. "How I cried out to you, my God, when I read the Psalms of David. Those hymns of faith, those songs of a pious heart in which the spirit of pride can find no place. I was new to your love. I was a catechumen living at leisure in that country house with Alypius, a catechumen like myself, and my mother who never left us. How I cried to you when I read those psalms. How they set me on fire with love of you. I was burning to echo them to all the world, if only it were possible, so that they might vanquish human pride. When I read the fourth psalm," it's our psalm, "how it moved me." Then he quotes, "When I call to you, listen to me, O God, and grant redress. In time of trouble you have brought me relief. Have pity on me now and hear my prayer. I quivered with fear, yet at the same time I was aglow with hope, rejoicing in your mercy, my Father. When I read the message of your Holy Spirit, how long will you be slow of heart? How long will you love vanity and seek after lies? For so long I had loved vanity and followed a lie. How I wish that my cries could have been heard by those who still set their hearts on vanity and still follow lies." Can you get the connections? So he's reading. This is his. "I read on. Be angry and stop sinning. This moved me deeply, my God, because by now I had learned to be angry with myself for my past, so that in the future I might sin no more. It was right that I should be angry in this way, for those who try to find joy in things outside themselves easily vanish away into emptiness. They waste themselves on the temporal pleasures of the visible world. Their minds are starved and they nibble at empty shadows. How I wish that they would tire of going hungry and cry, quote, "Who will show us any good?" And we would answer, "The light of your countenance, O Lord, is lifted upon us." For we are not the light which enlightens every person, but we are enlightened by you, that we who were formerly darkness might be light in you. How I wish that they could see the eternal light within us. Having tasted it myself, I gnashed my teeth that I could not show it to them. Their hearts looked out through their eyes on the world outside, away from you, as they cried, "Who will show us any good?" But there, where I was angry with myself in my inmost heart, where I had been stung with remorse, where I had put to death my old self and offered it in sacrifice, the quote again from there, where I had first resolved to renew my life and had placed my hope in you, a quote again, it was there that you had begun to make me love you and, quote, had put gladness in my heart. It was my eyes that read these words, but my soul knew their meaning. They brought a cry to my lips, and I wished no longer for the manifold riches of this earth, things on which I should waste time, only to be myself wasted by time. Whereas in your eternal simplicity, I possess true, quote, corn and wine and oil. When I read the next verse, a loud cry broke from my heart, quote, "In peace I will lie down and sleep. For who shall stand against us when the saying of Scripture comes true? Death is swallowed up in victory." It's a quote from St. Paul's letter. "For you do not change, and in you we find the rest which banishes all labor. For there is no other beside you, and we need not struggle for any other things which are not what you are. For, quote, you alone, Lord, make me dwell in hope." These things I read, and there was fire in my heart. I had snarled blindly and bitterly against the Scriptures, which are sweet with the honey of heaven and radiant with your light. And now I felt sick at heart over those who hate them. It's very beautiful, isn't it? And there's a saint meditating on Psalm 4. Couldn't do much better. Interesting at the end, see, I snarled blindly and bitterly against the Scriptures. He was a scholar, brilliant scholar, the best of his day. The top professor in Milan University at the early age of 33 or something. Brilliant. And when he read the brilliant Latin and Greek, you know, or Latin anyhow, I'm not sure he knew Greek, Latin texts, and he looked at the Scriptures, and it's so simple and, you know, unpoetic, a lot of it, and poor literature, do you know what I mean? So he kind of looked down on it. Thought it was in the Gospels and all that stuff, and whatever he picked up of it, he thought, oh, well, you know. So he was looking at it from the point of view of a literateur person. But then when he let his heart open to it, it got further in than anything from the Latin scholars, and now he's realizing how wrong he was to have read it so badly.